You're listening to RevOps FM with Justin Norris.
Every part of the business has its challenges, but if you ask me, marketing is one of the toughest functions to lead successfully. It requires a little bit of everything from you. Your job is part art and part science. You need to hire, coach, and retain talent with this huge range of skill sets that you may not even be a master of yourself. And then your job is to simultaneously create demand, capture demand, help sales convert that demand, help customer success retain and expand that demand. So your job is basically never done. So today, I really wanted to go deep into the hidden side of marketing leadership, the tips and the tricks, the trials and the tribulations. And so brought to you by the letter T, we have one of my favorite marketing leaders, Tao Ngo, SVP of Marketing at UpTempo. Tao, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be the tea today and to spill the tea.
Let's start doing that. Now, you've been a marketer for over 20 years per your LinkedIn profile. What makes a great marketer? Simple question to start with.
Yeah, and I would also keep the answer pretty simple. It's the hunger to learn, because marketing changes all the time. Best practices, techniques, tools, all that kind of stuff. It changes all the time. It's not like you go to school once and you're done. So the ability and the hunger to learn is really important as you enter new industries, understand new products, new ICPs, et cetera. So I think that's really important for marketers. The other thing, especially in tech, is the ability to embrace change, because it's having the mental fortitude to survive the ups and downs of the industry and also a lot of changes that happen in marketing. You need to embrace that change in order to be successful. And that's what makes it exciting, really. And the third thing I think is important for being a successful marketer is the ability to listen. So listening to the market, listening to your boss, listening to customers, listening to influencers, just being that sponge and understanding why they're doing things, how they're doing things. I think the ability to listen has carried me so far in my career. So I think it's just simply that, the ability to learn, embrace change, and listen really well.
I love that. And there is an interesting kind of left brain, right brain dichotomy that I alluded to a moment ago. When we think about the sort of learning that you described, must every marketer be both data literate and curious about people and about human psychology, or is it okay to be more grounded in one or the other?
I think if you're going to be a marketing leader, you have to have both. Because certainly as individual contributor jobs, there is definitely a slant depending on your role. But as a leader, I think you do need to have an understanding of data and appreciation for data, as well as being creative and understanding how human beings work. And this is really why I picked marketing, because it was the perfect mix of data and creativity, because I had considered being a writer, being an accountant, and I picked marketing because I could flex the creative side of my brain and come up with ideas, but also be able to look at the numbers and be data driven as well. So I think both is really critical as a leader.
So marketers are just some strange hybrid of a failed writer and a frustrated accountant. Is that what we're saying?
Well, look out for a screenplay later. I have lots of stories to share.
I want to give a shout out to the sponsor of today's episode, Knack. You know, I love marketing automation software, but let's be honest, the email and landing page builders are usually terrible. You can't make it nice without a developer, and marketers are going to find a way to break things or go off brand. You do not have time for that. So Knack is totally different. You set the guidelines and then give your users a building experience that's slick, modern, and beautiful. When they're done, everything goes to your map at the push of a button. And don't worry, it supports global teams, approval workflows. It's got your integrations. So head on over to revops.fm/knack. That's K-N-A-K. And get a special offer just for my listeners.
Has this profile changed over the course of your career? I would assume that 20 years ago, data was still very important. But has it increased in prominence within the kind of overall marketing skill pool?
Absolutely. There was a lot of vanity KPIs we focused on way back when. And today it's much more revenue focused and being business savvy as well. So it's not in the realm of sales or finance. Marketing leaders have to understand their numbers and understand how they're impacting business goals and understanding the marketing investment and where to make smart investments there as well. So it's not like a black hole. So I definitely think there's more data, more need to be data-driven now than 20 years ago, for sure. I think that's a good thing.
You know, as you see some people sometimes, and sometimes I feel this way myself, that we've almost overcorrected in the direction of data, from the old joke about marketing being the arts and crafts department to, no, we've got to be data-driven. We've got to tie everything to data, be able to quantify and measure everything we're doing. And that can straitjacket you as a marketer sometimes. Have you ever felt that, or do you view that as a problem?
Absolutely. I only care about data if it helps you make a decision. So there's nice to have data that you can have, but if it's not actually going to help me make a decision, then I don't care about it. Somebody on the team should care about it, but I don't care about it. So I'll get a 20-slide deck from somebody giving the analysis on the program. I'm like, okay, I only care. I spent this much amount of money. What did I get back? Who's paying attention? And it's nice that you have all these slides, but I only care about that. Give me that one slide, right? So for me specifically, I definitely keep it high level in a lot of things on what decisions I'm going to make, because we're all stretched for time. And I don't want my team to go down rabbit holes, spending hours looking at every single click, et cetera. If they're not going to do anything with that data, it's a waste of time. And we move very quickly on this team, so we don't have a minute to spare on useless data. So there's definitely some people that would probably dig in a lot more. I only care about if it makes a difference to how I'm going to spend my money and time and projects and priorities.
So let's walk in a little bit into this marketing leadership role that you've held for a number of years now across a number of different organizations. So this isn't your first rodeo here at UpTempo. How do you think about the role of the marketing leader? What is job number one for you?
Job number one is to help the company reach the goals. So whatever the business goals might be, I need to make sure that we get there, but that the journey is enjoyable. That's really important to me. And when I say the journey is enjoyable, I need to have fun. My team members need to have fun. The customers need to have fun. Because if you're only churning out stuff and you're not enjoying it, I'd rather just be a writer then. Go out, write my novel, write my screenplay. But it's important for me to really enjoy the work and enjoy what I'm doing and making sure that people, for sure, learn and progress and perform, but people have a good time doing it. That's really important to me. That will obviously change from leader to leader, but this is why I can put in so many hours and I can look at the details and I care so much and people care so much, because they really care about what they're doing and they really enjoy doing it as well. So for me, the journey is as important as the results.
It's interesting that you mentioned fun, because I think not many people would have had that on the tip of their tongue in the sense of what is the most important function as a marketing leader. But it's something that I really resonate with. And I mean, if I'm not having fun at work, it's very miserable. I'm sure most people feel that to some degree. What is the operating rhythm, if you like, of your team?
We definitely have processes for everything. So like any other team, we have campaigns, campaign briefs, kickoffs, project management tools, standard meetings, all that kind of stuff. But every single meeting we have and every Slack message we have, there is a playful element to it. And there's an ease at which we're conducting our meetings as well. And I love going to meeting, especially with my team, and we can just share and tease each other. I'm being honest, and they know I'm not being rude or anything like that, but I'm just being authentic to myself, and we can have an honest conversation about the copy, etc. So everything you do or say and how you conduct yourself in meetings, it has to be kind of enjoyable. Otherwise, it's such a slog. So I think if you were to peer into our Slack channels, you would see that all over the place. And if you were to look at the edits that I provide and the comments I provide, you would also see that there's a lightness and there is a playfulness as well to it, so that people get a laugh out of the day as well.
certainly makes it easier to have the tough conversations, and there's not always 100% agreement on everything, at least not in the marketing teams I've worked in. And I think where it comes back to as well, you didn't use this word, but to me, it speaks to trust, right? Because when you trust each other, you can have a bit of fun at each other's expense.
Exactly. I think there's a book out called something about radical candor or something like that. I think some people misinterpreted that and just began being very direct with people. But if you don't have that foundation of trust, then it just becomes rude and mean. So that's the thing. You have to build that trust with somebody. They know where you're coming from. They know you just want great work, and they know your personality as well. So there's no offense taken as well. So I think that's really important to be able to be honest with them about their work. And when you make your own mistakes, I think that's really important for leaders to also recognize when they've made an oops. And so people feel comfortable with it as well. I remember there was this one customer summit. I accidentally moved this sign for the shuttle to the wrong floor, and the customers got confused where to go. And our field manager at the time at the company was like, well, what happened? How did it get moved from the right spot? I'm like, who did this terrible mistake? This is outrageous. And everybody knew it was me. I knew it was me. But I'm like, eh, well, it's what it is. So to be able to admit your mistakes also helps as well. But yeah, it's all about trust. They know I'm going to admit when I've made a mistake as well. And so it's easier for them to also do the same.
You know, I was a consultant before my current job, and I saw inside a lot of different companies, and, you know, chat with people even now from different companies, how things are going with them, talking about their careers. There are so many toxic environments out there where it's just ruled by fear and mistrust and politics. It can be very cutthroat. It's one of the reasons why, like, I'm looking at a job, really look at Glassdoor very carefully. It certainly does give you an indication of things like that. This is a really priceless trait, I think, where you can create an environment for people to have fun in, where they feel a certain sense of psychological safety. Have you found that as useful as a sort of almost like recruiting tool or something that can draw people into the team?
Well, I'm very honest when I interview candidates or if I'm being interviewed for a job as well. So if I'm going for a job, I want them to really understand the environment that I can thrive in my personality, and that I'm very outspoken and I don't like rules. And if they have a problem with that, they'll see it right away in the interview. They'll get my vibe. So they know what they've signed up to if I've come on board, right? So if there are companies that are very political and very uptight or rigid about rules, there's no way they would ever hire me. Not in a second. And it's the same way when I hire people too. I want them to come on board and not be order takers, but be marketers. Every single person on the team is a marketer. If you're a designer, it doesn't matter. If you're a writer, you are a marketer. And I'm expecting you to step up and have an opinion and care about things. And while we have fun and we can be playful, etc., I can also be very direct with my feedback, because I think that's really important, getting frequent, direct, and timely feedback. I'm all about that. My team definitely knows I don't hold back and I share the feedback freely, but they're used to it. And so I want people to feel comfortable with that before they come on board. I'm usually the last one that candidates speak to in the job process, because I'm the one that's trying to scare them away. It's like, this is what it's like here. We move really fast. There's lots of change. We have a massive workload. We have high standards. I give a lot of feedback. I'm a very direct person. So if you don't like it, it might not be the right place for you. So I'm the scary cop at the end. It's been very helpful for people to understand if this is the environment for them.
I perused your LinkedIn recommendations as part of, you know, just getting my head into the plan for this discussion, how it would go.
Stalker.
I know it's creepy, but one of the themes that emerged from those recommendations, of which you have quite a few, and many of them from your former team members, people that you coached, and there was really this theme about you as a leader. You are paying them very well, or you're doing something well. Either way.
Oh, it's definitely not the pay.
Just Just teasing. But yeah, they were really, really just effusive about how you helped develop them, your leadership style. So you're doing something good there. What's your philosophy for coaching developing team members? How do you approach this challenge? Because it is a very challenging thing to do to help develop somebody.
It is challenging. I think you have to meet me halfway, right? You have to want it as well. It's not like sitting back, oh, coach me to the next level. Like you need to do part of the work too. So for me, I always think about their future. Where do they want to go? Because not everybody wants to be a marketing leader, right? Not everybody wants to take all these rungs up the ladder. So it depends where they want to go. And keeping that in mind, that's how I coach them, right? So if they do want to be managing a team in the future, I try to give them advice and real experience in that area. And if they just want to be the best that they can be as an individual contributor, we work on that as well. But I always give real examples for every piece of feedback I have, because one of the annoying things I had in my career where people would say, just don't think you're ready yet, or you need to do this. I'm like, what do you mean? Tell me the things that I need to do and I'll do it, right? So I never liked that. That feedback was so vague and there was never real examples. So in addition to giving concrete feedback, I always do a lot of workshops as well. So I like to give my team workshops to solve real problems. So we just did a workshop on working faster because one of the themes was managing workload. So I did that this week and I gave a workshop with them about managing communications. There's lots of Slack, lots of email, lots of everything. How do you manage all that? And also workshop on how to better review and edit things so there's not too much back and forth and we can get things done faster. So I'm a big fan of real hands-on workshops to help them overcome these things. And also examples. I'll send examples of, for example, if I'm listening to a TED Talk and somebody's talked about how women can insert themselves in meetings or whatever, I'll send that to the women on my team, et cetera. Or if I see an example of somebody managing a meeting really confidently, I'll share that with them as well. So I'm always thinking about things that each person cares about in their path and real meaty things to help them get there. And I think that's what they appreciate because I could just do the work, but I'm thinking about how do I get them to the next step that they want to get to. They don't have to stay here forever. They could go on to another company and be leaders and successful, and that would be fantastic. And I've done that. I've built so many leaders that have worked for me, and that makes me incredibly happy and fulfilled. So they know I care about their next steps and not just about how they're doing at the moment for this company in this role. I think that matters.
When we talk about your team, what size of team are we talking about right now? Just to give people that context.
I think it's a teeny tiny team of like 8, including us. So we're living the do more with less. We're living and breathing it every day. So it's always a challenge about what are we going to drop? What are we going to be fine to let go out the door, et cetera. So it is a challenge about managing workload and expectations for sure.
Let's say you have a marketer that is underperforming. Maybe you feel is missing key skills or certain competencies or certain mindsets or attitudes. Like, how do you approach that situation? So that is a difficult one, I think, for many leaders.
Yeah, well, if it's skills, that's so much easier because then we'll just get them skilled up, right? It's like you have gaps in here and here. Let's get you a book. Let's get you a course. Let's get you trained up on a weekly basis, and then we can see where you're going, or you can shadow me, or you can see how sometimes I've hired a consultant and they will shadow that consultant as well just to get their skills up to snuff. So skills is easy. Attitude is harder. So if there's an attitude like, same thing what I've said about order takers, right? If they see themselves as, I'll do my job here and I'll just check off the task. I'm not interested in that. There's accountability to your project. And if you don't understand what this entire campaign is about, if you don't understand the goals of this project, and if you don't understand the messaging, then that's a problem. So every person that's involved in this project needs to understand that and needs to care about what happens. It's like, I've done my part, but so-and-so, are they ready? Or are they prepared? Or I see a problem here, I should bring it up. I always liken it to, because I went to business school and we did group projects all the time, right? You're just together with four people, six people, whatever, you have to get a group project done. And that's how I tell them, it's like a group project. It's not like each person is only doing this thing, but you're responsible for delivering this project and the success of it. And you're all going to get the same grade. The prof is going to give you the same grade. So if you don't understand all the components of it, it's a problem, right? And if you don't understand, that's also something we can fix and we can sit down and we can explain it. But if there's no hunger to learn, if there's no hunger to improve the customer experience and just do what we've always done, then that is a problem. And it's funny because I also did a workshop this week for the women of Uptempo on how to have hard conversations. Because that's also an area that I thrive in. I don't have a problem having hard conversations with people. I look forward to it because I just need to get stuff done. If someone's underperforming, they will know immediately. And they will know for every single instance that it happens and the expectations that come with that and what they're going to do. And I always share my feedback and I'll say, what do you think? Do you think that's fair? Let me know what you have on your mind. And then you might understand, like, maybe they're not in the right role, or maybe they don't care about this, or maybe they're having real challenges. You got to hear what their side is as well. But I think clear, timely feedback is super important on improving somebody's performance, attitude-wise or skill-wise.
It was kind of the philosophy of hire slow, fire fast, common expression. What do you think about that?
I understand its theory. I totally get the fire fast thing in theory. I get it. It's much harder to do because people are human beings and you want to give people a chance to step up to the plate and improve. So it really depends on their attitude and if they want to improve. So I tend to actually fire not as fast, to give people that time and space to improve. And it's worked. Sometimes people just need that leeway where they can just get some stuff under them before they can get going. I want to exhaust every single avenue possible before I call time of death. I want to give them every single chance to succeed. Tools, reading, examples, talk to other people, working together, more meetings, feedback. I want to give them the opportunity because it is their livelihood. It has huge impact on their life and their self-esteem and people they might be supporting and people connected with them, etc.
I think it also has a big impact if they are getting that feedback quickly and early and every single time. It's quite often that doesn't happen. You have these little things, and maybe as a leader, you're uncomfortable or you don't want to invest the time to give that feedback. So it's kind of like a stone in your shoe or something. So then it just gets bigger and bigger. And then people just get walloped, like at performance review time or crushing surprise. Like, what? Like, why didn't you say anything sooner?
Blindsided because they don't have the opportunity to change. And I don't think that's fair. And that's why I'm really famous for saying, hey, do you have 5 minutes? If there's a meeting that's gone sideways and I don't like something that has occurred, I'll slack. I'm like, hey, do you have 5 minutes? And they know, like, you know, those 5 minutes might not be enjoyable, might be terrible, but I can't let it go. I need to tell you immediately what I didn't like, why I didn't like it, what we need to change. So you have the opportunity to change it.
But what I have noticed, and feedback is a big part of the work culture where I am as well. And so you really try to practice that at bare minimum on a weekly basis. When you normalize giving that feedback, often it just becomes this normal corrective little nudges. And that's way better than keeping your cards close to your chest and that, as you say, blindsided performance review time or just something explodes.
And there's big feedback and there's little feedback. So you also have to give people an idea of when it's like, oh, this is just like a minor thing and this is like a problem and we need to talk about it because I'm about to lose my mind. And I do say that. And then they're like, oh, she said lose her mind. That's a bad sign. So I had said, for example, You did an A-plus job. I had some finer suggestions for future, but keep in mind, this was A-plus, full stop. So then they can understand, oh my God, okay, I feel good, and these are just minor things, right? Versus the more serious feedback.
So let's say you're building your marketing team from scratch today. You know, you've got a handful of draft picks here. What roles would be your first, second, and third hires?
That's pretty easy. No matter where you're at, the executive team and board will want accurate numbers immediately, and they need to be done right. So I need MOPS on first, and they need to be able to do campaign execution and maybe manage the site as well. So whenever there's a small team, you're wearing multiple hats. So MOPS first for sure, because I can't spend my time doing that. Secondly, product marketing for sure. Because we need to have the right messages and understand the market and understand how we're going to market in order to have a chance at succeeding, right? And they will also double as writing marketing content too, two hands. And then third is demand marketer. We need somebody to run the programs, run the ads, and also be able to write. So those are the top three roles that I will hire in that order, because I can outsource everything else. I can outsource design, outsource writing, outsource web dev, outsource SEO, outsource field. I can do all that.
And right now you are reporting to CMO, Jim Williams, who
yes.
Another great marketer. Mm-hmm. I've known him a little bit from some of his work in the past.
Some say maybe. Maybe.
You have a fun relationship with him that you've alluded to. How do you divide responsibilities? Because you have kind of, in essence, you're both, you know, marketing leaders. It's not a huge marketing team. How do you think about dividing up the pie between you and Jim?
It is unusual, and it's not by design. It was just that I got hired at Alacadia, then we got acquired by Brandmaker, who was hiring him, and then Hive9 came. So these three companies came together, and then we're like, oh, there's two of us. Hey, hi. So I formally report into him, but I think we boss each other around equal amounts. I think we're pretty good that way. So he takes care of product marketing. That's really his background, product marketing, sales development team, as well as marketing operations. So he actually takes those portfolios. And then I take demand, content, customer marketing, field marketing, and corporate columns. So what people would think of as traditional marketing, and that's how we split it up. But we speak regularly, at least twice a week, and so we're in the loop on everything that we're doing, but that's basically how we divvy things up. And there's a lot of work to do just splitting that up.
And so it's an effective partnership, it sounds like. Not that you could necessarily say if it wasn't, but it sounds like it is.
Exactly. For the moment, it is an effective partnership, yes. And that's, I think, really key in terms of the environments and the managers that I thrive under, is just let me do my thing. That's really important to me. I mean, we'll have our debates, which is great. You get the best ideas out of them. And 1% of the time he's right, which is fine. But just in general, just get out of my way. Let me do my thing. And I think our backgrounds in B2B marketing, and we're aligned on the kind of DNA that we want on this marketing team and the kind of marketing that impresses us as well. So I think it's good being aligned that way.
What keeps you up at night, professionally speaking? What's your biggest, what do your night terrors look like?
It's so funny because I don't get a lot of sleep to begin with. I don't know that I'm the kind of person that worries like that. Because, you know, when I am up, it's because I'm finishing off work. Because I love it so much. I sound like such a nerd. But I am up late doing a lot of work because I love what I'm doing. I love the projects. And I don't really worry as much. The thing that's tricky is results can take time. So I know I'm doing the right things. I know we're doing the right motions, the right programs, and we're seeing the qualitative feedback come in. And it just takes time, and I just need everybody just to hold on, because everybody wants immediate results and any kind of dip and people are freaking out, and I'm like, just calm down. I know this is the right thing. So it's just like anything. If you're taking your health seriously and you want to be healthier, well, you're going to have to go to the gym. You got to sleep. You got to eat the right foods and work out and drink water, and all of that takes time, right? Everything that is worth having takes some time. So I wouldn't say it keeps me up, but people just need to be a little bit more patient and know that we're doing the right thing. And that's what matters. Doing the right thing, doing the right programs, and not going for the quick fix because everybody else is doing that way. And I don't know if that's the right path to success.
Yeah. And that's a big topic that I want to dive into. But first, I want to maybe just understand, you talk about, you know you're doing the right mix of programs and channels for the year. How do you think about that planning process? I mean, that's UpTempo is like a marketing planning execution software. So it's very much in your company DNA. What does that look like for you at the beginning of the year? You know, you just get a number from finance, or walk us through what that process looks like.
I love planning personally because it's the part in your marketing career you're never really involved with when you're junior, right? You just get kind of told what to do. I'm like, wow, I'm in charge now. This is great. You're like the holder of your destiny, right? So it's really always exciting to me. And that's when the mix of data and creative get together. But we follow a standard process, and we're still not ICP. So we're not enterprise, like the complex, large marketing organizations that use our software or that follow our consulting, et cetera. So we're still a small team. So it's a little bit easier, but essentially it's the same steps. So everything comes from what the business goals are. What are the targets going to be the next year? And then we get a rough marketing budget number to kind of work with as a scratch pad, I will say. I was like, no, we'll start with that and see where we are. And then we talk about, okay, what are the marketing goals that actually connect to those business goals? Instead of the things that we want to do, we want to make sure we're grounded in things that matter to the company. So we set that. That's a conversation that I have with my CMO. And then we talk about marketing strategy and things that worked last year, things that didn't work, things that we know we have to do, things that are a gap. So we talk about the major initiatives and priorities that we want to do in order to meet the marketing goals. And then we think about the large campaigns that we want to run for each one of those goals that ladder up to the marketing goals, that ladder up to the business goals too. And then we do high-level campaign planning with the team. So we talk to them about business targets, the marketing goals, laddering up to that, the strategy, and then the big campaign themes. And then we get to work with the team in terms of fleshing that out, a high level schedule by month of when those programs will go live. And then we do a back and forth dance with finance on the budget. So we do have like a best guess top down, and then we do bottoms up, really looking at the nitty gritty on what that might take, and then see where the numbers fall out and shake out. So then that's a negotiation with finance. And if there's a major change to that budget, thankfully that also changes the targets that we have as well. So we're not beholden to these massive goals if our budgets are going to be cut like a huge amount as well. And then there's the socialization of it. So I mean, we're a smaller company, but I've worked in bigger companies where you really do have to just talk to everybody, make sure they understand the marketing strategy, the priorities, what we won't be doing, and how that impacts their organization. And that's a lot of face time as well. So I usually do that with a lot of leaders internally before we actually unveil it to the rest of the company. So I've already listened to them, heard their concerns, shared why we're doing it this way, et cetera. And the way that we roll it out, at least at UpTempo in the company our size, is we record a short video. It's a 20-minute video between myself and Jim that explains the goals and how we think we're going to achieve that. And at the end, we actually do a product demo. So we open up the UpTempo tool and show them the plan that we have in the tool, and the marketing investment and the calendar as well. So we drink our own champagne internally, and we want everybody in the company to understand this is how marketing internally uses it as well. And then we circulate that around to everybody, and they're free to ask questions and comment, et cetera. But it's always there, that recording and the PowerPoint deck and then the plan and the up-tempo tool. And then it's executing the campaigns, which I think is a lot more straightforward in terms of brief, kickoff, and project management. And of course, coming back and measuring that inside the tool as well. So I think it is the same steps that our customers should be taking at much larger scale and much more complex, of course. But that's how it goes. And I really enjoy the whole process of planning because half of it is scientific. The other half of it is creative, right?
And when you're building that mix, there are often certain programs that are just always on, like maybe like an SEM program. You continually optimize and manage it. And then you may have some campaigns that are a bit more direct response. And then you may have some campaigns that are more, let's call it demand creation or brand awareness. The terminology can vary depending on your preference. How do you think about an intelligent blend of things that are predictable all the way up to like what you alluded to before? We think this is going to yield results down the line, but it's not like an immediate put a dollar in, get $1.25 out, something like that.
Yeah. So we do have bread and butter programs that have worked in the past. So we just up the ante in terms of maybe having more of them or making the topics even more closely aligned to topics that we care about, or maybe selecting different types of partners or customers to involve. So I would say it is probably 50-50, which is definitely riskier than most. So 50% are programs that we know work and 50% are, hey, let's take a gamble. Because one of the things I'm really good at is selling something. So if I believe in a program and I want it to happen, I'm really good at getting people on board. So that's what I love is like, hey, I think this will work. Not only does it sound good and it's creative or whatever, but these are the real reasons why I think it would work. And that's what's exciting. Let's just change it up and see where the chips lie.
It's a good transition to the subject. I'm going to call it influencer marketing. And I don't know if you think of it that way, but one of the reasons why we know each other and why I think many people in the ops community know you is through some of the programs that you've run with folks like Daryl Alfonso, or more recently, I've actually been involved. You've sponsored me to be involved in a really fun program where, you know, we're giving takes. You've got six different marketing ops leaders giving takes on different topics every month. We're recording that. The huddles with Daryl, you know, have been a huge success, at least in terms of engagement with the community. You've got like hundreds of people coming to them at various points in time. How did you get on to that train? Where did you get that idea from? And how do you think about those programs? How are they viewed internally? Maybe just walk us through, like, what do those mean to you?
I think it's coming from what I said before about being authentic and enjoying the journey. Because I always put myself in the place of our prospect or customer. And there was just a ton of webinars and ebooks out there that were super boring. So I'm like, oh my God, I want to put another one out there. I want to do something interesting. So it's more fun for me as well. And right now, people trust each other. And not only analysts and reviews or whatever, but they just trust their own community and people they respect. So we needed to get brand awareness on Uptempo because it's a new brand with the three companies coming together. We didn't have a massive budget as well. So I need to punch above my weight. And it was like prison yard rules. Like you find the biggest guy and you fight him, right? And that's what I did with Daryl, except he was really nice. So I reached out to him and said, hey, do you want to talk about things that we can do together? This is what we're all about. Like, I don't think I wrote anything that was particularly mind-bending, but it was authentic to my voice. And he's so nice. And he responded. It's like a cold pitch. And I gave him an idea that I had because I've seen this work with CMOs. There's a CMO live event that happens on a weekly basis, and it's quite popular. And I thought, I don't think there's one for marketing operations. And I think that people are challenged with the same things and going through the same hardships, and there's an opportunity for people to have a safe space to share. So we were like, okay, well, let's try this thing for 3 months and see what happens. And it was so interesting to see because I was like, who's going to speak up? Maybe people aren't going to speak up. But I was so surprised. We typically don't get through five discussion topics in an hour because there's so much participation. So many people have things to say or questions. And of course, the chat's just crazy. Can't keep up with that. So it seemed to work. Just getting people to be real and to speak frankly seems to work. So let's continue doing that. And let's think about other people in the community that are respected, that have opinions, that can weigh in on different topics as well. So that's how Mops Unplugged came to be as well, because I just really wanted to elevate different voices as well in the Mops community. So I like the idea of different cohorts for 6 months. And it's the kind of thing that I would like to consume out there. That's how I want to receive information, is like people who have been there, done that, their unvarnished opinions. That's more interesting to me than anything else. And even our customer webinars that we do around planning, we had IKEA and HubSpot just say, hey, this is how we do it. These are the challenges we had, and this is how we managed it, and this is where we're at. So people are interested in that, the how. Show me the how. Show me what's really happening, instead of things that are a little bit too dry and theoretical and right. So it's about thinking about how you'd handle being in prison, basically.
You touched on something that I really care a lot about, which is like, what type of content would I want to consume? You know, you're lucky in a sense that you're a marketer and you're selling to marketers and you're talking to marketers or, you know, people within that discipline. So that is a plus already. But something I think about a lot, and, you know, in my kind of day job, we're selling to a learning persona, but it's the same idea. What would they want to consume? Mm-hmm. And I think there's this tendency we have as marketers to almost like view what we do as this like industrial process where we can like bring people in and like nurture and like mm-hmm. move them along this conveyor belt, like a lump of ore or something exactly. getting refined, and just giving people something that is fun and valuable and giving them a space to connect and talk about their shared challenges and pains and vent a little bit. And you don't record them. It's not like your typical webinar thing.
Right. No sales deck, no sales pitches, no recording. And I've had salespeople try to come on. I'm like, sorry, this is like just for MOPS or people that are responsible for the MOPS portfolio. And I don't let my own salespeople attend. So they're shut out. But the thing is, that keeps the integrity of the conversations yeah. that you have, right? That it truly is a safe space. And what you said before about like, we always think about everything in the way that it should work. Like, hey, I'll send out an 8-email nurture program or 12 email. And at the end of it, they're going to be ready to buy. It's like, that's not really how it works. No matter how compelling your emails or messages are, you just have to be ready to meet people where they are. So all you can do in the meantime is make sure they understand who you are and you're providing value with them. And when they are ready, they're like, oh, well, wait a minute, I know this up-tempo company. I have a planning challenge. I'll contact them. But I don't think it's as easy as this magical 8-email nurture.
You alluded to before the challenge about getting people to just hold on with these sorts of initiatives. There is this urgency that people have, and it's understandable. So you mentioned being very good at selling things. How do you do that? How do you explain your strategy and create this space and this freedom to say, like, we're going to need to run these huddles for like 6 or 9 months before we start to see people coming in and, you know, be able to connect those dots? How do you give yourself that freedom?
Well, I do share the numbers and the survey results and the comments after each event as well. And people can see the energy with each event and the numbers and the comments that we get from people, and it is an indication that we're doing something right and we're giving back something of value to the community. And when you do look at leads that come in or opportunities that are closed or opportunities in flight, you can see their journey, and it's always involving something to do with our events or our content, right? And maybe it's not the first thing or the last thing or whatever it is, but it is part of their journey in understanding up-tempo and eventually buying us. It's an important part of it. And I always think about it as like a soccer team. When you're on a soccer team and you win a game, you win the game. It's never like, oh, defense won it or strikers won it or midfields won it. It's like, we did the plays together to create the right place to score. It's never like, oh, the striker scored and that's what won the game. It's like us as a team worked together on a strategy. We each played hard. We each had our roles on the field, and that's what won the game. It's always a team victory. So that's how I see it. It's never like sales versus SDRs versus marketing. We're all after the same thing, and we each provide value in that journey for that person. And so long as we hold strong in the strategy that we have and do our part, it's a win for all of us. So I know it's easier said than done for sure, but I'm just too busy firing. I'm watching Top Chef right now. I'm firing out the plates. Too busy to think about exact attribution or anything like that. I just need people to understand that we have all this positivity coming our way, and it does mean something, and we do see it in the numbers as well.
So just to drill into that a little bit, because I think this is a very interesting point, but it's a place where many people struggle because, you know, CFOs, finance, whoever, they people say, I need lead numbers, I need MQL numbers, I need SQL numbers, whatever it is, that numbers that they want. And you're getting the engagement data from the events themselves, which is great because you can see who logged in and you can see how many people attended and what their feedback was. So that's awesome. Are you then thinking about how many of these people are in our ICP or are, you know, collecting kind of how did you hear about a self-reported attribution when they eventually do enter your sales funnel to try to see if the event was impactful upon them? How do you try to connect those dots?
Yes. So we always look at if our ICP, the percentage of registrants or attendees that are ICP. So we always keep an eye on that, because if it was a very small number, then really we're doing great things, but for the wrong people that we're trying to target. So that's important. The other thing is every single opportunity that gets created, I look at the notes. I'm like, oh, let's see what they did, right? Or their friends. Okay, well, it looks like 10 people from this brand have been attending these events for the past year. So while they closed, came in maybe from something else or talked to whatever, we know that they touched those events and that was an important part of it. So I'm just always looking at the ops created for sure. But yes, we look at the percentage of ICP for registrants, attendees, and we use the opportunity of these valuable content and events that we have to reach out to our ICP as well. So it's a great way for us to reach out and say, hey, not looking for a credit card, but here's something that you might enjoy reading or get value from or want to join. So it's an opportunity for our salespeople to show that we can provide them with value as well. So it's useful that way too.
Maybe the last question we have time for, with all the things you have going on, help us understand what is like a day in the life of Tao look like, and how do you organize your time, think about prioritization, think about having the right level of situational awareness. What does that flow look like for you?
Well, first of all, my alarm goes off at 6 a.m. Then it goes off at 6:05, then 6:10, then 6:15, and then I rush to get ready. I'm not a morning person, but we have Germany, so I always have 7 a.m. meetings. And I'm sometimes doing my hair or putting on my cream during meetings. But my days are 4 to 8 hours of meetings per day. It's a lot of meetings. I do block off my Fridays generally from meetings. And I have meetings typically with only internal stakeholders. So I rarely meet with vendors or anything like that. And the meetings are generally a lot of work and project meetings. I review probably and make decisions probably no fewer than 20 times a day. So there's always things that come across my desk. I'm like, yes, blue, or no, do that, or yes, spend 200, whatever. I make a billion decisions a day. And then I also get Asana tasks assigned to me so I can keep track of really what people need from me. And I usually try to clear that out before the end of every day as well. It's usually quiet after 3, though. So usually most of my meetings from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Pacific, because that's when Germany and Boston are done with the day. And then I'm working on quiet work, I call it. So work where I am writing or viewing or doing my own things without meetings till 6-ish, go to a sport, come back, do quite work again. I don't recommend people work this often, right? It is not healthy, not a good work-life balance, terrible. I need to get this all done. And so I'll do some quiet work, and then I stay up usually till midnight to do my Wordle, because we have a Wordle Slack channel, and I got to get it in when the Germans are getting it in. So I am hands-on in my working meetings with my team members, as well as the Asana tasks. And then I have high-level meetings with the CMO and other L2 leaders in the company so they understand what's going on. And of course, time that I have with our customers and people that we're working with, such as yourself as well. But yeah, it is a very meeting-heavy day, which is why it needs to be fun.
So I love your leadership philosophy, love what you're doing. And yeah, it's been a great experience for me as just someone out in the community working with you, working with UpTempo on some of these projects. So thank you for including me. And thank you for coming on the show today. It was a really fun discussion.
No, thank you for having me and taking the time. It was great just to reflect on my experiences, because like I said, I'm constantly out there talking about marketing planning, talking to the MOPS community, and it's taking the time to think back on my own journey, which I don't really get to do very often. So it was valuable. Awesome.
All right. Well, we will speak again. Bye for now.
Yes. Bye for now.
Hey, everyone. I want to invite you over to the RevOps FM Substack community, where you can sign up to get rough transcripts, show notes, longer form articles, and other bonus content. Just head over to revops.fm/subscribe to get free access. I'd also love to know what you thought of the episode and to hear suggestions for topics you want to learn about. Feel free to leave a comment on Substack or send me an email at justin@revops.fm. Thanks for listening.